and Henry Lee Lucas were responsible for those, as well as for the fire that destroyed the house on June 23, 1981. At the same time, other detectives from Hollywood were at the Lake Butler facility interviewing James Redwine, Betty Goodyear's troubled son, who had fallen in with Toole after his return to Jacksonville from a treatment center in Miami. Redwine, serving time for arsons he committed along with Toole, said that while Toole often acted meek and timid, he could fly into rages, especially if he had a weapon available. Redwine described a few such incidents for the detectives, and also confirmed that he had seen Toole in possession of a large knife with a brown wooden handle. However, Redwine said, he was not going to submit to a sworn statement about any of this. He did not want to get involved in the investigation, period. On Saturday, Hoffman and his cohorts, Smith and Stanley, were back in the homicide unit at the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. Once again, Toole spotted him passing the open interview room and called out after him. Hoffman ignored Toole, but Buddy Terry caught up with him and explained that Toole was being insistent. "Just go see what he wants," Terry urged. Hoffman may not have cared what Otis Toole wanted, but he was on Terry's turf and needed some element of cooperation if he was going to accomplish anything in Jacksonville. Thus, he walked into the interview room and informed Toole brusquely that he, Toole, was being represented by public defender Elton Schwartz, and that Schwartz did not want Toole talking to any investigators without his attorney present. To Toole, none of it mattered. "I do not want to be represented by anyone," he told Hoffman. "I want to speak to you about Adam Walsh, and I do not want to be represented by any attorney." Hoffman glanced about the room, where any number of fellow law officers stood watching, waiting for his call. Certainly, Toole seemed well aware of his rights, and this was anything but a coercive situation, as cops from several different jurisdictions could testify. He was stymied in his own investigation. What was the harm of hearing Toole out? Suppressing something of a sigh, Hoffman sat down and began to take the eighth statement offered by Otis Toole concerning the murder of Adam Walsh. Toole began by telling Hoffman that essentially everything he had confessed to concerning the murder was correct, from the time of his arrival in South Florida and the abduction of Adam Walsh from the Sears Mall in Hollywood, until his arrival at mile marker 126 on Florida's Turnpike and the subsequent decapitation. But the part about burying Adam's body in that same location was not exactly right, Toole said. "Everything I told you about the killing, about the chopping, all that's true," Toole told Hoffman. "As to Adam's torso, though, I wrapped him in some blankets and put him in the trunk." Following his brief stop to dispose of the head in the canal, Toole said, he drove on to Jacksonville, arriving in the evening hours at 708 Day Avenue, where the remains of his mother's gutted house still stood. At that time, Toole said, he took Adam's body out of the trunk and carried it around to the backyard and placed it in a gutted-out refrigerator that he had used as a kind of incinerator in the past. He'd start a fire and toss in coils of coated wire to burn the insulation off and expose the copper, he explained, which he could then sell at junkyards around town. In this instance, however, his aim was quite different. After he'd gotten Adam's torso inside the refrigerator, Toole heaped on some pieces of wood and doused it all with gasoline. He lit the fire then, hoping to cremate the body, but to his disappointment, the fire went out fairly rapidly. Some of the skin on the body had turned black and crumbly, but it was not in any way completely burned. So he did what he had to do. He heaped on more wood, poured on more gasoline, and set the blaze going again. After he was finally satisfied with the results, Otis tried to push the gutted refrigerator on its side so he could dump the remains onto a blanket he had spread out. But the refrigerator was heavy to begin with, and with all the debris and ash that now filled the insides, Toole couldn't budge it. So he went back to the Cadillac, found a shovel, and used that to scoop out the remains onto the blanket. He gathered up the blanket and its contents, wrestled the bundle to the Cadillac, and managed to heave it up and into the trunk. He was about to slam the lid down when something occurred to him. What if there were hot ashes still lurking in that mess somewhere? They could smolder for hours and eventually start a blaze in his trunk. Tool might not be smart, but he knew about fire. He also knew that no one had bothered to turn off the water at the ruined house, and so he went to fetch the hose that still dangled from a spigot outside. He opened the faucet and doused the trunk and its contents until he was sure that no embers could have survived. By then it was late, and Tool, who'd had himself a full day, was tired. He slammed the lid of the trunk, climbed into the Cadillac, and slept there through the night. In the morning, he rose to clean off his machete and his shovel, and then hid the tools under a still-standing portion of the ruined house. After that, he drove the Cadillac to the city of Jacksonville's northernmost dump, where he backed up to a muddy area and tossed the water-soaked bundle out. Satisfied that the wadded blanket looked no different from any other bundle of discarded goods in the vast wasteland, he was about to get back into the car when it struck him that the sodden carpeting of the trunk might now contain traces of blood. So he pulled that up from the floorboards of the trunk and tossed it out into the dump as well. That night, long after he knew all the employees would be gone, Tool returned the Cadillac to the yard of Reeves Roofing. And whatever happened to that machete he had used, Hoffman wanted to know. Tool wasn't sure what he had done with the blade, finally, he told Hoffman. It could have ended up over at Spencer's Motors in Jacksonville, though. He'd left a lot of his stuff in paper bags over there at one time or another. Hoffman's notes do not indicate whether or not his heart quickened at this chance comment of Tool's, but if it did not, one would surely wonder why. Finally, after all the fruitless searching, Otis Tool had unknowingly suggested that Hoffman was in possession of a piece of evidence that would directly link the killer to the crime. Asked to describe this machete further, Tool told Hoffman that it was in a green canvas holster that kept the blade covered, and that he had wrapped tape on the wooden handle to keep from getting blisters from chopping. It seemed a perfect match to the machete that Hoffman had confiscated at Bennett Motors. The handle had been taped, the grips were wooden, the blade was housed in a green canvas sheath, and one of the substances on the blade looked very much like tar, indicating its use by someone involved in the roofing trade. Hoffman next asked Tool where he had stayed between the time he took the Cadillac back to the roofing company on the evening of July 28th and the afternoon of July 31st when he moved into one of Betty Goodyear's houses with Rita. Tool wasn't too sure. He might have slept in a portion of his mother's house that still had its roof, or he might have slept in one or another of the parks in the area. Hoffman concluded the interview at 11:08 that morning, asking Tool to explain why he had lied before about burying Adam's body down near mile marker 126 on Florida's Turnpike. Tool didn't say anything about the sandwich that Hoffman had slapped out of his hands the day he'd led detectives to the site where he'd decapitated Adam, nor did he mention that it pissed him off mightily that Hoffman had called him an asshole and a retard on numerous occasions. Yes, he had told Hoffman that he cut off Adam's head and buried his body nearby on that day, he admitted, but there was a very simple explanation. I was just fucking around with the police department, he said. Saturday, November 19th, 1983. Following that interview with Tool and a break for lunch, Hoffman and his fellow officers from Hollywood tracked down David Gilliard, who'd worked as sales manager for Wells Brothers Used Cars starting in November 1982. He remembered taking in the 1971 black over white Cadillac, Gilliard told the detectives, and recalled very clearly that there was no carpeting in its trunk. Rather than go to the expense of paying for new carpet for such an old vehicle, he had ordered one of his lot men to simply paint splatter the trunk to give it some appearance of finish for sale. After they'd spoken to Gilliard, the detectives went back to Faye McNett, just wondering, they said, if the Cadillac she'd sold to Otis Tool had carpeting in its trunk. Indeed it did, McNett told them. What kind of a question was that, anyway? On Sunday, Hoffman, accompanied by Lieutenant Smith and Sergeant Stanley, took a drive to the North Jacksonville dump, where they took photographs of the area, with more than 2 years of trash heaped on the site since Tool said he had disposed of the body there, it seemed little else could be done. Early Monday morning, seeking further corroboration of what Tool had told them, the detectives spoke with the Jacksonville Fire Department arson specialist who had investigated the burning of Toole's mother's house at 708 Day Avenue in June of 1981. The lot had been leveled back on December 10, 1982, by an outfit called Real Co. Wrecking. But as to what had and had not remained standing after the fire, there were numerous photographs in the files, Captain Hinckley said. The Hollywood detectives were welcome to them. At about 9:30 that morning, Hoffman interviewed Robert L. Hammond, who owned Hammond's grocery at 700 Day Avenue, next door to Toole's mother's house. Yes, he knew both Toole and Henry Lee Lucas, Hammond told the officers, and he well remembered the day that Toole's mother's house burned down. He also observed that Toole stayed at the house on several occasions after the fire, and he had often seen Toole digging up and burying various articles of trash in the backyard. Toole eked out a living by collecting junk, Hammond said, and often stored various items he'd found in his mother's yard. He brought back discarded refrigerators, then hacked them apart for the aluminum he could sell at salvage yards. And he also used the gutted refrigerators as incinerators, where he burned the insulation off wiring to expose the saleable copper underneath. Hammond's mother, Sarah, was present at the interview, and she too told Hoffman that she had seen Otis Toole back at his mother's house after the June 23rd fire. Hoffman next spoke with a man named Charles Lee Hardiman, who claimed to have known Toole for about 3 years. The two of them would ride around picking up junk like refrigerators, stoves, and furniture, and then bring it back to 708 Day Avenue, where they'd break it apart for whatever salvageable materials might be obtained. And yes, he had also seen Toole use the carcasses of refrigerators as incinerators. When Hoffman asked if he ever knew Toole to carry weapons, Hardiman confirmed that there was a shotgun around sometimes. And how about any large knives? Hoffman wanted to know. I never seen him with knives, Hardiman said first, but then corrected himself. Well, he had one like they used in the old days. Just how large a knife was this? Hoffman asked. I don't know, Hardiman said. I saw it, he added, holding his hands a foot or more apart. Then he raised his thumb and forefinger with perhaps a 2-inch gap between them. A blade about this wide. What kind of case? Hoffman asked. A steel case. What color? Hardiman shrugged. Rust, he said, going on to explain to Hoffman that it was the kind of knife that you could fix onto a gun barrel. A bayonet? Hoffman asked. Yeah, Hardiman said. In his first confession to Hoffman, Toole had begun his description of the decapitation by saying he'd used a bayonet. But Hoffman had responded by saying, like a machete, and Toole had subsequently followed the detective's lead in referring to the weapon he'd used as a machete. It could have been a simple misstatement, given the limitations of Toole's intelligence, but then again, the matter was certainly worth pursuing. When did you see that knife? Hoffman asked. Hardiman gave him a look. Well, it was mine, he finally admitted. I left it there at the house and told him to sharpen it. And he kept it? Never returned it to you? Right, Hardiman said. When did you give it to him? Hoffman next asked. Hardiman thought. It was when his mama was living, that much I know. So that would have been before May 1981? Yeah, Hardiman said. Following the conversation with Hardiman, Hoffman drove with Smith and Stanley to Daytona Beach, about 2 hours south, where they met briefly with William O. Toole, another of Otis's brothers. William refused to speak with them in any detail about Otis, however, and the trio drove home to Hollywood that evening. It was on Wednesday of that week that the Fort Lauderdale Sun-Sentinel ran the story in which Louisiana detective Donnie Fitz told reporters that Otis Toole had confessed to the killing of Adam Walsh during an unrelated interview. When reporters called Hollywood PD for a comment on Fitz's allegations, Public Information Officer Tony Alderson dismissed it as nothing new. We believed Toole the first time, Alderson said. Meanwhile, the FDLE lab in Jacksonville had concluded its examination of Toole's Cadillac for Adam's fingerprints. Alas, no latent prints of any value had been found. Almost a week went by without any significant developments, though the treatment center in Hialeah, where Betty Goodyear's son John Redwine had stayed prior to meeting Toole, did confirm to Hollywood PD that Redwine had gone on vacation from the facility on July 24, 1981, and had boarded a bus bound for Jacksonville at 9 that morning. Conceivably, Redwine could have been helpful in placing Toole's whereabouts if Hoffman could find him. On Wednesday, November 30, 1983, Detective Hoffman reached a clerk named Filior in the Jacksonville Water Department who confirmed that water service to the home of Toole's mother at 708 Day Avenue had in fact been disconnected for non-payment, but not until September 9, 1981. This information was needed in order to verify a part of Otis Toole's confession in which he indicated that he used the hose in the rear of his mother's residence to wash out the 1971 Cadillac trunk area in which there was trace evidence of blood, Hoffman wrote in his notes, adding that the information did corroborate Toole's claim that there was water available to him on the date in question. Later that day, Hoffman phoned Dennis Bedwell, supervisor of the City of Jacksonville Sanitation Department. Since Toole had claimed that he disposed of the body of Adam Walsh in the North Jacksonville dump on the morning of July 28, 1981, Hoffman needed Bedwell to provide the names of the employees who were on duty between the time of that facility's opening and, say, 3 p.m. Bedwell checked his records and came up with a couple of names and phone numbers for Hoffman, but there is no indication that the detective ever spoke to either employee or searched sanitation department records, or those of other landfill operations, for any information that might have confirmed a visit by Toole at the time he claimed to have been there. The following day, Thursday, December 1st, Hoffman took the machete he'd found at Bennett Motors to the Metro-Dade Police Department crime lab with a request that technicians perform Toole marking tests on the weapon. Though the blood tests were inconclusive, Hoffman hoped that the striations found on the spinal column at the base of Adam Walsh's skull could be matched to the blade. The Broward County Medical Examiner's Office had also found a couple of embedded paint chips during their further cleanup of Adam's skull, and Hoffman brought the fragments along for Metro-Dade's analysis as well. If the chips could be identified as paint or other materials traceable to the 1971 Cadillac, that, too, might serve as evidence linking Toole to the crime. The following Tuesday, December 6th, Hoffman and Lieutenant Smith traveled to the Williamson County Jail near Austin, Texas, where Henry Lee Lucas was being held, hoping that Lucas might be able to implicate Toole in the killing of Adam Walsh. Lucas told Hoffman and Smith that it was quite possible that Toole could have been responsible for such a crime, for he and Toole had traveled various parts of the United States together at one time or another, and had committed any number of murders both independently and as a team. However, as to this particular crime, Lucas said he had no knowledge of it whatsoever. On that Friday, Hoffman received more disheartening news, this from the Miami-Dade Crime Lab, advising that their best efforts to date had not been able to produce a positive identification of the Toole markings on Adam's vertebrae as having been made by the machete he'd submitted. Analyst Bob Hart had worked the evidence with great vigor, Metro-Dade Crime Lab Commander Edward Whitaker assured Hoffman, but all the physical factors combined appeared to be leading to no positive identification. As to the white fragments or paint chips that Hoffman had submitted, those were still being analyzed. Though the chips did not appear to be composed of automotive paint, the report said, they had obviously come from something, and the fracture patterns observed at the edges of these chips were deemed very likely sufficient to permit an absolutely positive ID if whatever material they had broken from could be recovered. Thus, the questioned vehicle should be searched with extreme care for such material, and if found, for any defect or break in any surface. A few days later, however, on December 14th, Lab Commander Whitaker called to inform Hoffman that, in fact, the examination of the machete against the markings on the vertebrae had come up negative. They were still trying to identify what the white fragments he'd submitted might have come from, Whitaker said, and they would let him know the moment any information was available. There exists no record in the case file that Hoffman ever contacted the FDLE crime lab regarding a search within the Cadillac for any object from which the chips might have derived. On Thursday, December 22nd, FDLE got in touch with Hoffman to report that no fibers from the vacuum sweepings from the front or rear seat carpets of the Cadillac had matched fibers from the machete's canvas sheath. On the following Tuesday, December 27th, FDLE technician Glenn Abbott traveled to the then-vacant lot at 708 Day Street and began to dig in what had been the rear yard, searching for evidence that the body of Adam Walsh might have been placed there. At one spot, about a foot below the surface, Abbott uncovered a pair of light green shorts and advised Buddy Terry of the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office of his findings. Since Reve Walsh had told detectives of dressing her son in a pair of light green shorts on the morning of July 27, 1981, Terry thought it a significant discovery. He called Detective Hoffman in Hollywood to let him know and had the shorts placed in an evidence locker until he could pick them up. New Year's Day of 1984 dawned with Hoffman back in Jacksonville, still trying to trace Toole's movements at the time of the crime. On January 4th, he met with Timothy Harold Jones, the clerk who was behind the counter of the Little Champ store the day that Otis Toole burst in, screaming that someone was going to shoot him. The clerk also recalled that, moments later, Howard Toole followed Otis in and proceeded to slap him around. That all had taken place on August 1, 1981, Jones said, though he also stated that he remembered selling Otis a pack of cigarettes and a can of beer 1 or 2 days prior to the fight, which would have meant July 30th or 31st, if Jones's memory was accurate. Meantime, Lieutenant Smith checked the various distances between the Jacksonville Greyhound bus station and the places Toole might have walked to upon his arrival on July 25th. It was 3.6 miles from the station to his mother's home at 708 Day, and 7.8 miles to the Reeves roofing lot from which he claimed to have taken the Cadillac, an hour's walk to one, 2 hours to the other. At 8 a.m. on Thursday, January 5th, Hoffman arrived at the former site of the home at 708 Day Street, along with Lieutenant Smith and two other detectives from Hollywood PD. Also present were Detective Terry, three technicians from the FDLE Crime Investigation Unit, and a representative of the Jacksonville Public Works Department. They were convened to excavate the property in a systematic search for evidence. Using a front-end loader with an 8-foot-wide bucket, the team employed the standard method for excavating crime scenes, dragging the property 2 inches at a pass until they had reached depths anywhere from 4 to 6 feet. About 2 hours into the search, as they dug in the northwest section of the lot, the machine unearthed bone fragments that resembled a section of a human pelvis. 3 hours later, in a different section of the lot, two other unidentifiable bones were uncovered. And at about 3:30 p.m., in a third quadrant of the lot, a left-footed yellow rubber Zori, or flip-flop, in a small child's size, was found. All of the items were duly catalogued by FDLE crime scene technician Abbott and turned over to Detective Terry. While Hoffman stayed behind to watch over the rest of the search, Terry and Lieutenant Smith hurried to the Duval County Medical Examiner's office with the bone fragments. Whatever hopes they had, however, were soon dashed. These were the remains of some type of animal, the ME said. No chance they had come from a human. On Friday, Hoffman spoke with Yvonne Grant, the manager of the Little Champ, where Howard Toole committed his battery on his brother Otis. That day was August 1, 1981, Grant confirmed, and like her employee, Timothy Jones, she remembered that Otis Toole had in fact been in her store previously, only a day, or at most 2 days, prior to the incident. The entire period from October 1983, when Toole made his first confession to the murder of Adam Walsh, to the following January 1984, during which Toole made at least 7 more confessions to the crime, must have seemed very much a time of 1 step forward, 2 steps back for Detective Hoffman and the Hollywood PD. After 2 years with essentially nothing, a man already convicted of another senseless murder and implicated in dozens of others around the country had come forward to claim responsibility for the abduction and murder of Adam Walsh. Yet despite the repeated confessions and the offering up of detail of the crime that it seemed only the killer could have carried with him, Hoffman could find no evidence linking Toole directly to the crime. It must have been a period of intense frustration for Hoffman, and one senses from a pattern of dogged, repetitive inquiries down the same oft-tracked trails a desperation in his actions. But whatever degree of frustration Hoffman may have felt, or whatever adjective one might employ to describe the tenor of his investigation, it seemed that he was weary of whatever Otis Toole had brought to the table. As evidence, consider what happened next. Jacksonville, Florida, January 6, 1984. Though there is no indication as to who called for the meeting between Detective Jack Hoffman and Otis Toole on the first Friday of the new year of 1984, there is certainly no reason for Hoffman to have requested it. He already had 7 sworn statements from Toole confessing to the killing of Adam Walsh, and if Hollywood PIO Tony Alderson is to be believed, most everyone at Hollywood PD believed Toole from the beginning. In any case, at 9:56 on Friday morning, January 6th, Hoffman, accompanied by fellow Hollywood PD detectives Smith, Nalen, and Banks, entered the interview room at the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office and once again sat down with Otis Toole. "What is the reason that you are giving us this statement regarding Adam Walsh?" Hoffman began. Toole fumbled a bit, but he seemed clear enough ultimately. I didn't kill Adam Walsh." Hoffman glanced at his fellow officers, then back at Toole. "You didn't kill Adam Walsh?" Toole shook his head.
"No."
Hoffman's next question had an odd ring to it. Instead of asking Toole who or what had motivated him to call them in to say such a thing, Hoffman took more of a petulant tack. "And why have you stuck with your confession all these months from the first time I met you?" Hoffman asked. "Can you tell me why you stuck to your story all this time?" Though there may seem a certain relevance to the question, it also seems that Hoffman had been prepared for what he was going to hear during the interview. In any case, Toole managed an answer for the detective, lame as it may have sounded.
I was trying to hang Henry Lucas at first, but I found out he was in jail."
Another interviewer might have pointed out to Toole that he had known for months that Lucas was in jail, and then gone to work on Toole, trying to determine just who had drawn up the scenario for the present morning's meeting. But Hoffman did none of those things, and by 10:06, 10 minutes after it had begun, the lead detective on the case signaled to his associates that the interview was over. Hoffman then asked Buddy Terry to hand over the green shorts and yellow rubber Zori that had been recovered during the excavation of the property where Toole's mother's house had stood, and Terry complied. Hoffman took the shorts and flip-flop back to Hollywood with him that evening and placed them in the PD evidence room where, rather than being shown to John and Reveille Walsh for purposes of identification, the items, inexplicably, remained unexamined for more than 13 years. For all intents and purposes, Jack Hoffman's investigation of Otis Toole as a suspect in the murder of Adam Walsh was over. For whatever reason, his innate distrust of Toole, his inability to let go of Jimmy Campbell as a suspect, or simply a natural inclination to step away from a frustrating task, Jack Hoffman had finished with Otis Toole. Shortly thereafter, the last vestiges of Detective Hoffman's investigation of Toole were wrapped up without fanfare. In late January, the Tallahassee lab reported that hairs found in Toole's Cadillac, vacuumed from the seats, headrest, and carpet, did not belong to Adam Walsh. Subsequently, according to an FDLE memo, all the evidentiary items examined by both the Tallahassee and Jacksonville labs were returned either to the Hollywood PD by registered mail or directly to Detective Terry of the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. Otis Toole's difficulties with the law were scarcely over, to be sure. Just 2 weeks later, at the end of a 3-day conference in Monroe, Louisiana, hosted by the Ouachita Parish Homicide Task Force, law enforcement officers from 19 states issued a joint announcement that Henry Lee Lucas and Otis Toole
had been positively linked to 81 murders out of the 150 or more that they claimed to have committed. During his various interviews with those agents, Toole explained that, quite often, after Henry Lee had sex with some of the female victims, he would turn them over to Toole to be killed. Toole, inflamed with anger and jealousy, was only too happy to comply. A number of the victims had suffered extensively with multiple stab wounds and deep, though not fatal, cuts along the arms, thighs, and lower legs. Several had been disemboweled, and a number had been doused with diesel fuel, stolen by Lucas and Toole during erstwhile stints on roofing crews, then set afire. In Jacksonville, Buddy Terry had enjoyed far more success with his own investigation of the arson case in which Toole had caused the death of Betty Goodyear's tenant, George Sonnenberg. Toole went to trial on those charges in late April and somewhat predictably testified that he did not in fact set the fire that he had on numerous occasions previously confessed to. The defense introduced Dr. Eduardo Sanchez, a psychiatrist, who testified that Toole was a pyromaniac, his intelligence on the borderline of retardation. He was childlike and impulsive, Dr. Sanchez said, subject to bouts of overwhelming tension that had to be relieved. Setting fires is one of the ways he does it, Sanchez said, and in such terms it might sound almost rational. Whatever the jury thought of Dr. Sanchez's explanations, they seemed far more compelled by the evidence presented. On Friday, May 11th, that body took 35 minutes to reach its verdict. Otis Toole was guilty of the arson murder of George Sonnenberg, and the recommended penalty was death. As he was being led from the courtroom, a furious Toole whirled on Detective Terry, who had supplied much of the evidence during the trial.
"Friends don't testify against friends," Toole shouted at Terry. "I'm going to fuck you."
Toole, who had been formally charged with 9 other murders in Texas, Colorado, and Louisiana by that time, was sentenced to death for the murder of Sonnenberg and was finally transferred back into the state of Florida prison system at Lake Butler on May 18, 1984. Shortly after his arrival at Lake Butler, Toole granted an interview to Jacksonville Times-Union reporter Mickey Valenti, during which he repeated his confession to the murder of Adam Walsh. He took Valenti through the details of the abduction, explaining once again that he had done it to keep him for myself, and the decapitation, I put both hands on it, the machete, and I chopped his head off. And he included the information that he had given Hoffman about what he had actually done with Adam's body, though he had a grisly coda to add. He had taken the body back to Jacksonville and stuffed him into a discarded icebox on his mother's property, Toole told Valenti. And then he said, "I took that machete and I cut out some of his side and I ate some of it." And following that, he burned the corpse and tossed the remains into a Jacksonville City dump on the following day. As to the specter of execution for his current conviction, Toole told the reporter that he was not really concerned. "It might not really happen," he said. "You can always appeal for years and years." Only 3 days after that sensational story appeared, on May 24, 1984, the FDLE returned the principal piece of evidence in the case, Toole's Cadillac, to the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. There had been no word from Hoffman or the Hollywood PD in the wake of Toole's sordid public confession, and with no hold placed on the car as evidence, it was subsequently sold by the sheriff's office to a used car dealer. A St. Augustine resident named Cerise Safwat bought the vehicle, despite his complaint that it lacked carpeting on the floorboards and trunk. Less than a year later, after the car began to exhibit serious engine problems, Safwat said, he sold it to a junk dealer as scrap for $50. On October 18, 1984, Detective Hoffman granted an interview with the Florida Today newspaper in Cocoa. In it, he told the reporter unequivocally that Otis Toole was no longer considered a suspect in the murder of Adam Walsh. "He was a suspect until we were able to put holes in his story," Hoffman told a reporter, though he did not say what those holes were. His confession only vaguely matched the actual details of the killing, Hoffman claimed. An aide to Broward County State Attorney Michael Satz said that his office concurred, though he also made it clear that the call was entirely Hoffman's. Hollywood police apparently saw fit to say that Toole is no longer suspected, and we're just agreeing, press aide Dave Casey offered. When Buddy Terry heard the news, he was not surprised. As far as he could tell, Hoffman had never really taken Toole seriously. He believed that Hoffman had missed an opportunity to nail Toole for the Walsh murder, but at least Toole was in prison, Terry thought, and facing execution. Clearly, he would have to put the rest out of his mind. Which he might have done were it not for the astounding news that Terry soon was to receive from his superiors. Hoffman, it seemed, was not quite finished with Otis Toole and the Adam Walsh case after all. He had filed a complaint with Duval County authorities that Terry had supplied Toole with case file information that Toole used to concoct his confession. Terry had done this, Hoffman alleged, because the Jacksonville detective and Toole had formed a secret agreement to write a book based on Toole's sensational confession. Terry, who hadn't even heard of Adam Walsh the first time he overheard Toole confessing the crime to Brevard County Detective Steve Kendrick, was dumbfounded by Hoffman's allegations. Still, while the matter was investigated, he was to be transferred out of the robbery and homicide unit, where he had served as a detective for more than 12 years, back to the Uniform Patrol Division, assigned to the Graveyard for Wayward Detectives, otherwise known as the Communications Center. Chapter 5. As Evil Does. Tell me about some of the weapons you've used to kill your victims.
I've used jack handles, 2x4s, shovels, axes, run them over with a car, strangle them with stockings, skip ropes, phone cords, you name it.
And shot them?
Oh, yeah, shot them, sure. In the head, in the chest, in the back, in the stomach, and sometimes in the top of the head. Sometimes, if somebody's been going down on you, you have to be careful there, though.
And this is with a handgun?
Usually. A .22, a .25, a .357 Magnum, but sometimes a shotgun. And I've used a rifle, too.
Is there any weapon you never used?
I never used an ice pick. That would have been good, though. I wish I would have used an ice pick just once.
Otis Toole to Texas Rangers, March 24, 1984. Hollywood, Florida, November 14, 1984. Given the train wreck that the investigation of Otis Toole had become, the November Wednesday that would have marked the celebration of Adam Walsh's 10th birthday instead seemed to serve as a milestone of frustration. A year or so before, it appeared that his killer had been found, and while it would not bring their son back, John and Reve Walsh might have found a certain kind of relief had Toole been charged and tried. At the very least, some sense of justice might have prevailed, some semblance of the possibility of order restored to their world. The Walshes were certainly not the first parents to be visited by such predation and calamity. As they soon found out in the aftermath of their loss, thousands of families around the country had suffered similar tragedies and had been similarly frustrated in their ability to find help from local law enforcement agencies and the justice system. Children went off to corner stores or out in backyards to play, and they simply never came back, or sometimes were brought back in body bags. In most cases, stricken parents could do little but grieve, but more than a few took the time to share their sadness and their frustration in letters to the Walshes. None of the aggrieved parents who had suffered the disappearance or murder of a child had any idea exactly what to do, but many sent checks to the Walshes urging them to use the money any way they saw fit. And then, in September 1981, less than 2 months following Adam's murder, the Walshes received a call from the office of Florida Senator Paula Hawkins, who had tried unsuccessfully to get the FBI involved in the search for Adam at the outset. Senator Hawkins had joined the push on Capitol Hill to pass legislation that would require the federal government to maintain a centralized database on missing children and those who had been found dead but unidentified. It seemed ludicrous to supporters of the bill, the Missing Children Act, that you could report your stolen car or horse to the FBI and have that agency spring immediately into action, while a child could disappear without so much as an eye blink from federal crime fighters. Outrage over the 1932 Lindbergh baby kidnapping had resulted in the passage of the Federal Kidnapping Act, the so-called Lindbergh Law, making it a federal offense to transport a victim across a state line or use the mail to send a ransom note. Ostensibly, the act gave the FBI the authority to pursue kidnapping cases, but the agency had maintained a long-standing reluctance to interfere with local police in such matters. It often made for bad politics, for one thing. For another, most kidnapping cases turned out to be the result of messy interfamilial wrangling, and for yet another, they were reluctant to create more work for themselves. The official FBI line was that local agencies have more mobile manpower necessary to efficiently pursue kidnappings. Indeed, though Walsh had pleaded with the FBI to get involved in the initial search for Adam, and the agency pledged its support, records show that no such action was ever taken. The message that was passed down was this: if it got to the point where Hollywood PD was searching for a suspect somewhere out of state, then the feds would be happy to lend a hand. Otherwise, the local cops were on their own. Though the prospects for passage of the proposed legislation were dim, a staffer for Senator Hawkins wanted the Walshes to go to Washington to lobby on behalf of the bill, and though it was a mission they would have to carry out at their own expense, they were more than happy to do so. At the very least, it was a way to vent some of the frustration they had felt from the outset of Adam's disappearance. It did not take the Walshes long to sense the enormous weight of indifference they were confronting, however. As even newly elected presidents have learned, trying to correct the conduct of business as usual in the federal bureaucracy is like trying to nudge an ocean liner off its path by standing on a rubber raft and pressing on the liner's hull with your bare hands as it speeds by. But, fueled by their outrage and sense of injustice, and buoyed by the support of so many strangers around the country, they had already formed their own nonprofit agency, the Adam Walsh Outreach Center for Missing Children, and they now threw themselves wholeheartedly into lobbying Congress on the Missing Children Act. In October 1982, the effort, which had been joined by a number of prominent politicians, including Henry Hyde, Paul Simon, Arlen Specter, and even staunch FBI supporter Strom Thurmond, paid off with the act's passage. And though it simply provided for the establishment of separate categories for missing children and the unidentified dead in the FBI's national database, the legislation marked the first time in history that missing children, runaways, child prostitution, family abductions, and a host of associated ills were formally recognized as matters that impacted an entire nation. For nearly 2 years following, John Walsh balanced his work for Paradise Grand Hotels and his efforts on behalf of the Walsh Outreach Center and various legislative efforts around the country. Adam, a made-for-television movie based on the case, had aired on October 10, 1983, just as Otis Toole was making his first confession to Brevard County Detective Steve Kendrick. Though one of Toole's cellmates later told investigators that they had turned the movie off that night and watched a football game instead, in other parts of the Republic, the film was well-received, critically and popularly. 40 million viewers watched as a roll call of photographs of 55 missing children played at the end of the film, and thousands of calls flooded the 1-800 number provided. As a result, 13 of those 55 missing children were reunited with their families. The Walshes, realizing the limitations of the Missing Children Act, next turned their attention to the establishment of a national version of their own nonprofit, a center where parents of missing and abducted children could go for practical help. Limited in effect as it was, the passage of the Missing Children Act had nonetheless broken the political logjam that impeded progress on such issues, and even President Ronald Reagan threw his support behind the establishment of a national center for missing and exploited children. Finally, on June 13, 1984, the center was opened in the form of a private organization funded at the outset by a $3.3 million grant from the U.S. Department of Justice. The only hitch was that John Walsh had to agree to serve on the center's board of directors, which in turn meant that he would have to leave his job with Paradise Grand. In some ways, it was a difficult decision. Revay had given birth to a daughter, Megan, in July 1982, and in 1984, she was pregnant again. John's pay would be a fraction of what he was making in the hotel business, but there was no fighting the tide. The Walshes had, in fact, helped accomplish the impossible. And once you had pushed against the hull of a massive ocean liner and felt it wobble from its intended course, you couldn't simply stop. There was great satisfaction for both John and Revay Walsh in what they had accomplished. But even though their work in Florida and Washington had helped other parents regain their children and see that persons who had committed such crimes received their just deserts, it did not ease the ache that filled them every time they thought of Adam. It did not matter that other children had come along. It did not matter that time had passed and that life had brought them many blessings. Their firstborn was gone forever, and his killer remained unidentified. And despite their suspicions that Otis Toole was responsible, the police certainly didn't seem to think so. For all the Walshes knew, then, the person responsible was still out there somewhere and was killing still. Adam's 11th birthday, November 14th, 1985, came and went with no word from the police, and as the years piled up and no progress was reported, the prospects that a break in the case would ever come dimmed. In January 1986, Hollywood Police Chief Sam Martin retired, and though insiders presumed that Leroy Hessler, prominently involved in the Adam Walsh investigation, would be his replacement, city commissioners were troubled by reports of rampant favoritism in matters of promotion, transfer, and assignment within the department. Instead of going along with Hessler, they appointed Richard Witt, a 27-year veteran of the City of Miami Police Department, to take Martin's place. If the Walshes thought it would mean anything in terms of progress on the case, however, they would be sadly disappointed. Witt had plenty to attend to without diverting his department's resources down what was, to him, a dead-end road, and thus Adam's 12th birthday passed with no word, as did his 13th in 1987. Then there arrived some news from a quarter the Walshes could scarcely have envisioned. A letter, dated October 4th, 1988, began, "Dear Walsh, my name is Otis Toole. I'm the person who snatched, raped, murdered, and cut up the little prick teaser, Adam Walsh, and dumped his smelly ass into the canal. You know the story, but you don't know where his bones are. I do. Now you are a rich fucker. Money you made from the dead body of that little kid. Okay, he was a sweet little piece of ass. I want to make a deal with you. Here's my deal. You pay me money, and I'll tell you where the bones are so you can get him buried all decent and Christian." Elsewhere in this despicable letter to John Walsh, Toole explained that he wanted $5,000 right away as good faith money, and Walsh's signed promise of $45,000 more once Toole had shown him Adam's bones. Toole closed by telling Walsh that Adam had been crying for his mother as he sodomized him. "If you send the police after me before we make a deal, then you don't get no bones, and what's left of Adam's hot pussy can rot," Toole warned. "Tell the cops and you don't get shit." Tell the cops, of course, is exactly what John Walsh did. He immediately gave the letter, signed by Otis E. Toole, in script that precisely matched Toole's signature on various prison forms, to Detective Hoffman at Hollywood PD. Walsh had become aware that Hoffman was unwilling to believe that Toole was Adam's murderer. It had gotten back to Walsh that Hoffman thought Toole was simply trying to draw attention to himself by claiming responsibility. And while Walsh was willing to accede to Hoffman's claims that there was no physical evidence linking Toole to the crime, he was sure that this blood-boiling message would reignite the detective's interest. Walsh was wrong. Hoffman simply filed the letter away. As it turns out, it was not the only letter that Toole sent out at the time. On the same day, he had also written an extortion note to Sears, explaining that he had cut a deal with a magazine to tell the story of how he had kidnapped, raped, and murdered Adam Walsh, and now, he said, he was threatening to tell the world how easy it was to abduct and assault children at their stores.
"I do my shopping for juicy little kitties at Sears," he said in his missive to the company.
But for a fast check, Toole said, he was willing to omit any direct mention of the chain in his magazine account.
"See you soon," he closed. "Bring money."
On the following day, Toole sent off another letter to the Orlando Sentinel. "Someone told my ear that a big paper like theirs might pay a nice amount for his personal account of the murder of Adam Walsh. And maybe once he told the story, people would leave him alone about it," Toole explained. "But there were conditions. No cops, no lawyers, just me and a reporter. Please make me your cash offer promptly." For its part, the Sentinel summarily forwarded the letter from Toole to Detective Hoffman. "Probably not anything new to you, but here it is for what it's worth," reporter Sean Holton said, before adding, "Let me know if anything comes of it." Toole sent a similar letter to the National Enquirer, which prompted reporter Charlie Montgomery to place a call directly to Jack Hoffman. His paper wasn't about to offer Toole any money, Montgomery said, but it was his intention to write Toole back and ask what new details he might be willing to supply. If he got anything interesting in response, he would let Hoffman know. Meantime, he reminded Hoffman, he would very much appreciate hearing should anything new turn up in the case. More than 7 years had passed since Adam's death, and 5 since Otis Toole had first confessed, and still, it seemed, the case exerted its great power over the collective psyche of the country. By October 12th, having received no offers from any of the major outlets he'd written, Toole was drafting To Whom It May Concern appeals, trying to find anyone who might be willing to pay him for his story. "Dear Editor," began one such, "my name is Otis E. Toole. I am the one who kidnapped, raped, murdered, and hacked to pieces the boy Adam Walsh in 1981. I also murdered 3 women and a man up around Holmes County, Florida." Toole went on to explain that he had already written to the sheriffs of both Broward and Holmes County, a rural enclave in a part of the Florida panhandle often referred to as L.A. or Lower Alabama, claiming that he was ready to confess to the aforementioned 5 murders. Furthermore, Toole said, he had decided to invite 1 member of the media to sit in on the confessions to ensure that police did not abuse him in the process. "If your paper is interested, then let me know," Toole said in closing. Copies of this letter and the one that had been sent to Sears were forwarded to Hoffman without apparent effect, but another letter sent to Broward County Sheriff Nick Navarro finally prompted some action. In this missive, Gerald Schaefer, a fellow inmate of Otis Toole's at Florida State Prison, explained that he was actually writing on behalf of Toole, owing to Toole's difficulties in reading and writing. However, Sheriff Navarro should have no doubt. Toole was responsible for the murder of Adam Walsh and for other unidentified murders in Broward County, and he was willing to admit formally to his involvement. "There were conditions," said Schaefer, former Martin County Sheriff's deputy serving 2 life terms for the murder of 2 teenage girls. He was to be present during all interviews with Toole. The interviews were to be of short duration, and both Schaefer and Toole wished to be relocated to the Broward County Jail. It may have seemed a presumptuous offer, but if most of the other letters that Schaefer wrote on Toole's behalf were dismissed, this one received significantly more attention. Monday, October 17th, 1988. Shortly after Navarro's office heard from Toole on October 17th, 1988, Captain Walter Lown, the commander of the Broward County Sheriff's Office Criminal Investigations Unit, summoned Detective Sergeant Richard Sheff, supervisor of the Homicide Unit, to a meeting where he handed over a copy of the letter they had received. Lown instructed Sheff to take one of his men up to the Florida State Prison to meet with Schaefer and Toole and try to assess whether there was any validity to the claims. Because Lown was aware of Toole's history of recanting his confessions, He wanted Chef to try to extract some detail or form of evidence that would lend credence to Toole's assertions. 2 days later, on October 19th, Chef and Detective Sergeant Fontegrassi made the 5.5-hour drive north to Florida State Prison, the state's maximum security facility. Stark, as it is sometimes referred to for its proximity to that aptly named town, houses the inmates considered to be the most dangerous in the system. It is also the location of the death row cell blocks, and while lethal injection would become the standard method of execution in 2000, at the time of Chef and Fontegrassi's visit, it was still Old Sparky, the electric chair, that held the preeminent place of prominence at Stark. Chef and Fontegrassi first met with Gerald Schaefer, who told the detectives that he had become acquainted with Toole while both were incarcerated there, and that at present he was functioning as Otis Toole's legal representative. Furthermore, Schaefer told them, he was interested in claiming the various reward monies still outstanding for the clearing of the Adam Walsh case. Toole had admitted to abducting and killing Adam Walsh, Schaefer said, and to dismembering the body, partially devouring it, and discarding what was left in a canal. Toole was willing to formally confess to the killing and appear before a grand jury in the matter. Toole also had told Schaefer about numerous other slayings he had committed in Broward County, in the vicinity of U.S. 27 and south of State Road 84, but at present Schaefer was unable to provide specific detail about those cases. That was all well and good, Chef told Schaefer, but neither he nor Toole would be taken out of Stark on any pretext until such time as they provided verifiable, independent evidence that could be used to support Toole's claims. Schaefer seemed to have anticipated this demand. Without hesitation, he pointed to a matter that no investigator had seized on in the 7 years that had passed since the murder. Toole had told him that he'd used two weapons to cut Adam up, Schaefer said, a machete and a bayonet. In his first confession to Hoffman, Toole had made passing reference to using a bayonet, but Hoffman began referring to the weapon as a machete, and Toole apparently began to follow the detective's lead in subsequent references. In any case, the possibility of Toole's use of two weapons had never been pursued. Even the claim of erstwhile companion Charles Lee Hardiman that he had given Toole a bayonet prior to the time of Adam's murder apparently elicited little interest. But Schaefer's claim would seem to have changed all that. Whatever had led to the confusion, Toole would be able to provide a more detailed description of both items, Schaefer assured the Broward County detectives. Accordingly, on the following day, October 20th, 1988, Detectives Chef and Fontegrassi met with Schaefer and Otis Toole. Chef recited the Miranda warning to Toole, who assured the detectives that he was well aware of his rights and was happy to waive them. Then Toole got quickly to the point, repeating his confession to the killing of Adam Walsh and stating that he was willing to testify to the matter in court. He had used a straight knife with a black plastic handle as well as a bayonet to kill and dismember the boy, he said, adding that the knife, presumably the machete, had been in the possession of Jacksonville authorities since shortly after his arrest when it was taken from his car. The bayonet, Toole said, belonged to his sister, Vanetta Cyphers, and was part of a display mounted on the living room wall of her home in Bostwick, Florida, about 40 miles southeast of the interview room where they were sitting. The detectives then pressed Toole to tell them where he had disposed of the body, and Toole told them that he had tossed various parts into the same canal where he had disposed of the head. The canal paralleled the turnpike for a 10-mile stretch or so, Toole said, and every so often he would pull to the side of the road and rid himself of another piece of the corpse. He couldn't recall anything memorable about any of the places he had stopped, save that little wooden bridge where he had thrown the head into the water. At times, Toole seemed to need help from Schaefer in formulating certain of his answers, the detectives noted, leaving them uncertain as to whether or not Schaefer had been coaching Toole in this undertaking from the outset. In the end, the only new information that Toole had provided was that pertaining to the bayonet. But on the other hand, all they needed was one piece of physical evidence to tie Toole to the crime. So off the two went to find Vanetta Cyphers. It took about an hour to drive to Bostwick, a remote, unincorporated community just west of the broad St. John's River, several miles south of Jacksonville. It is the sort of place one works hard to get to, a sparsely populated expanse of piney forest and scrub that has changed little since that part of the continent was formed. Perhaps the perfect place to be if you wanted to keep your distance from a relative like Otis Toole. When they got to Bostwick, the detectives made their way to the local post office where a clerk checked the records. Vannetta Cyphers had indeed once resided at 2942 Cedar Creek Road, he told them, but she had moved a while back and had left no forwarding address. Chef and Fontegrassi drove to the address the clerk had given them and knocked on the door of the modest house they found. A woman named Violet Fleck answered. She had never heard of anyone named Cyphers, she told them. Chef and Fontegrassi weren't particularly daunted by the response. Most cop work consists of exactly what they were doing. You knock on doors, you ask questions. One day, someone behind the screen will have the right answer, or so you hope. Across the street at 2941 Cedar Creek Road, Charles B. Council answered their knock and told them that there had in fact been a Rodney and Vannetta Cyphers living opposite him, but they'd moved out about a year earlier. He had no idea where they might have gone. Chef and Fontegrassi thanked Council for his help and moved along. It wasn't all that unusual, in the dimension of American life through which they were moving, and often moved, as cops, to trail after individuals whose existences seemed as transitory as those of tribal huntsmen or migrating birds. Yes, there was the America where people left forwarding addresses and kept in touch with old friends and neighbors and were as easy to find as a schoolhouse or a bank branch. But when you were looking for criminals, or the associates of criminals, or the families from which they'd sprung, you often found yourself traveling through such a netherworld as this in Bostwick, where identity and even existence often seemed as tangible as smoke. From the council residence, Chef and Fontegrassi traveled southward 10 miles or so to Palatka, population 10,000, and the seat of Putnam County. At the offices of the tax assessor, they learned that the property at 2942 Cedar Creek Road in Bostwick had been purchased by Violet Fleck, with whom they'd talked earlier in the day. She and her husband David had bought it from a Ralph Nelson Green of Jacksonville. Armed with this information, the two detectives then visited the Putnam County Clerk's office, where they discovered a record of Green's eviction of Rodney and Vannetta Cyphers from his property on Cedar Creek Road in 1987. And as it turned out, Mr. Green had employed the services of a Jacksonville attorney in the matter, one Wesley Wallace, Esquire. Detective Chef got Wallace on the phone and explained who they were looking for. Finally, it appeared he had knocked on the right door. Wallace happened to know that the Cyphers were now living with Vannetta's daughter, who was married to a man named Greg Bishop, and if Wallace was not mistaken, the Bishops had a place in Orange Park in Clay County, just south of sprawling Jacksonville. Chef accordingly called the Clay County Sheriff, who in turn located Greg Bishop, who dutifully called Detective Chef as requested. He listened to Chef and promised to have his mother-in-law call right back. Thus, following such a trail of crumbs, did Chef and Fontegrassi finally find the woman with whom they wished to speak. Perhaps it is not the glamorous stuff of series television, but this is the way detectives work, the real ones, the dedicated ones. There are those who weary of such deadening chores, of course. They let things slide. They get tired of traipsing through the rat warrens and the pine barrens after the smoke people. They never find the right door. At approximately 9 on the evening of October 20th, Chef and Fontegrassi, accompanied by Lieutenant Redmond of the Clay County Sheriff's Office, finally sat down with Vannetta and Rodney Cyphers. Mrs. Cyphers told the detectives that she had purchased an antique bayonet in 1979 and had mounted it as a decoration on the wall above her mantle. If her brother Otis or anyone else had removed it for any period of time, she would have certainly noticed its absence. When the detectives asked if they could take a look at the bayonet, Mrs. Cyphers paused. All this fuss over Otis had resulted in an unbelievable amount of hounding of her and Rodney by the press, she told the detectives. That is why the two of them had moved in with her daughter to get away from it all. It had all happened rather suddenly, she explained, omitting any mention of eviction proceedings, and quite a bit of their personal property was still stored in boxes. But she would find the bayonet, Mrs. Cyphers assured them, and as soon as she did, she would bring it to Lieutenant Redmond's office. The following day, Chef and Fontegrassi went to the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office to check on the machete. There they discovered that Detective Terry had in fact turned over such a weapon to the FDLE for testing, but that the department's labs had not been able to tie it definitively to Toole or the crime. Also that day, and somewhat to Detective Chef's surprise, Vannetta Cyphers actually showed up at the Clay County Sheriff's Office with the bayonet in hand. Chef arranged to have it sent to the Broward County Sheriff's Office crime lab, where it would be tested for blood and the blade compared to markings on the base of Adam Walsh's severed head. Though the recovery of the bayonet from Mrs. Cyphers constituted the sum of the efforts of Broward County detectives in their pursuit of physical evidence and their interview with Toole, Sergeant Chef concluded his report on the matter with the observation, "No review of this matter would be complete."